listener production.
You are listening to episode 103 of the Howie Games Part B with golfing guru Ian Baker Finch. Let's get on with it. So, Finchy, you've got that claret jug behind you there. 1991 Open at Royal Birkdale, and it's great to see you smiling about it now. What are your memories of the tournament that defined you as a golfer?
I guess the best memory I have is the shooting 64 on the Saturday, playing so well to get into the last group again for the third time, playing alongside my mate Mark O'Meara, who I'd known so well for so long.
On the tee, Ian Baker Finch.
And shooting 29, the front nine, on the Sunday.
This is Baker Finch for a birdie at the second. And he's made it. This is the man that's putted so well during the past few days and one of the few in this field that have done so, and he's now leading the Open Championship at 5 under par.
So they're the things that really define that championship. The fact that I played so well on the back nine Saturday, last group again, 29 the front. But just everything about that week, I came in great form. I came in believing in myself. First time ever in a major, I actually felt like I could win it. I knew it was my goal to win a major, and everything I did was to try and do that. But I really felt like, hey, if I can just do what I normally do, if I can somehow treat this like a regular tournament and just go play the way I've been playing, I could win this. And I did.
Yes, beautifully hold. And Ian goes to 6 under par. 2 strokes ahead.
And I had that feeling a few other times over the next couple of years. And I didn't win, but I played really well, but just didn't win, finished top 10 a few times, whatever. But that week was, it was a relaxing week. I had Jenny and Haley with me. You might be able to see a little photo there in the background of when I won. Haley was 2 years old, you know, inquisitive, trying to see what that shiny silver thing was, and Jenny was pregnant with my youngest daughter Laura. So it was just a special week, very, very relaxing. Steve Bann, a good buddy of mine, was over coaching Robert Allenby and a couple of the young guys, Glenn Joyner from the Australian golf team. He stayed with me, so he kind of kept us normal, if you will, family life during the week, which we liked. We're pretty basic. When Jenny and I and when we had the family traveled, we'd have a friend with us or we'd try and rent a little house. So we'd just sort of keep it pretty normal. And, went on to win it, went on to reach the goal and do all the right things. Pretty special.
Couple of questions for you about it. You wake up on the Sunday morning, as you said, after shooting a 64. The pink shirt, Finchy.
Yep.
You were always a style merchant. Tiger wears his red shirt. Was it pink because you're a style merchant? Did you think, wow, this could be the shirt I'm wearing when I have that photo that changes my life? Or was it just, right, there's the pink, I'm ready to roll here? It's a magnificent shirt
I've still got it. I wear the pink. Actually, I've got it in the clubhouse at Royal Birkdale, the shirt. I've donated all my memorabilia to the clubhouse, actually sent the medal back and everything. I've got it all there in the clubhouse. It's pretty special. But, yeah, I'd worn pink the year before when I was in the last group, and I liked it. It looked good. Jenny loved it. Haley's favourite colour was pink. So I was going to wear that pink shirt again on the Sunday. And, if you look back now, there's been quite a few players have worn pink on this. Rory McIlroy wore pink when he won the Open, and Justin Thomas, when he won the PGA, wore pink. Arnie used to wear pink a lot. Yeah, I just liked it. But once again, it wasn't like, hey, I'm going to look so good in this pink shirt at the end, because half of Australia was probably saying, you wanker, what are you wearing pink for? But it's, I felt good in it, and I was, strutting my stuff at that time, thinking I was pretty good.
You were strutting your stuff. I watched it again last night, the highlights, and it's incredible shots around the 18th, which is obviously the 72nd hole on the Sunday, and there's the bobbies, the English policeman leading you through just this massive people, and then you walk out onto the green and you've got your glasses on, there's a huge roar. It's a very dramatic scene.
Yeah, but the great man of the moment here, Baker Finch, Ian Baker Finch. Here he is, and I don't think anything can stop him now. Very emotional moment. Plenty of time to think about things.
Yeah, it is, and Marco O'Meara actually lost his shoe. He kind of staggered through. He had to find his shoe and put his shoe back on. And over the years, they've tried to put two or three layers of fencing in to stop that. But it's a part of the British Open history, mate, that everyone rushes out onto the 18th fairway and the bobbies sort of walk you up and stay around you so that they can't get to you, because it only takes one idiot, you know, and you can't finish, and you know what happens then. So as I said, it had been the third time I'd been in the last group. So it had been the third time I'd experienced that, which was very, very cruel. And, you know, thousands of people in the stands. And I wished now that I had been aggressive in the way I'd played the hole and tried to make par or birdie. But I thought, I've got a three-shot lead. I'm going to hit it in the left rough, because there was a big pot bunker at about 265. And the only way I could mess up was either to shank it out of bounds, which I was never going to do, or hit it in that bunker. So I thought, I can hit it in that rough and make five all day. So that's what I did. I hit it down the left side. I hit a six iron for my second short right of the green to avoid the other bunkers. And, you know, played for five, basically. So I didn't try and do anything special at the last. I just wanted to get my name on that jug.
There's some famous audio, and you're obviously talking to your caddy, and you've stuck it close and you just said, you like that one, Petey?
Yeah.
Brilliant audio.
Yeah, yeah. It was the 16th hole. We're playing into the wind, long hole, 465, and I hit a good drive and a four iron. And he was saying, look, all you got to do is hit this nice and easy, just get it up to the back of the green, two putt for par. And I just ripped this four iron straight at the flag and I said, you like that one, Petey? You like that one, bud? He said, I love it. I love it. Like that one, Petey?
I love it.
You like that one, bud?
Love it.
And why not? Right behind the pin. It's beginning to look like the victory walk.
But yeah, I was hitting it well, and that day pretty much hit where I wanted to hit it every time. And it was only a couple of times, like on 18, that I aimed away from where I really would like to have gone, but, you know, it's just being sensible.
Well, he's dreamt of this moment many times, I'm sure. This for the Open. In she goes. I wonder if he'll keep that ball and put it on a little back and stick it on the mantelpiece. Or maybe it'll go to some lucky lad or lassie on the side of the green. Great moment. Victory for Australia. And how proud they'll be. Benny and Haley. Daughter Haley.
The claret jug. Obviously, as you mentioned, Jenny is pregnant. You've got a little one. Do you have a couple of drinks out of the claret jug, or is it you're just exhausted and you're a family man? How does one celebrate achieving their life's ambition?
Ian Baker Finch, already with a glass of champagne in your hand. You're the Open champion. Has it sunk in yet, precisely what you've achieved?
I don't know. It's the first time Wayne Grady's ever bought me a glass of champagne. Normally it's a 4X or a Foster's or something, but cheers, Wayne.
Hasn't really sunk in, has it?
It feels pretty good. It feels great.
That night we had drinks out of it. There was a pub down the road from the little village we were staying in that sold VB and Foster's in the big cans. So Robert Allenby and Glenn Joyner and a few of the boys went down to the pub and grabbed some beers. A few other media guys came around and they bought Aussie red wine that they'd found at the pub. You know, in those days, I wasn't going to go fork out a couple of $100 for a bottle of Grange to travel with me to have in case I won the claret jug so I could have a Grange out of it, right? It's just, I didn't think that way. But, yes, we had Aussie red wine, and
Yes, we had plenty of Aussie beers and everyone had a drink out of it. And then later that night, I put a nice bottle of Aussie Shiraz in it and we went up to the club and Jenny and I and Steve Bann and the guard let us in. I showed him, hey, this is the jug I won today. And we went and walked the last hole and had a drink together there. So I don't think Jenny had a drink though. She might have held the jug because she was pregnant with our second daughter, Laura. But it was good times, good memories. And over the years, I always pull it out the Sunday night of the Open Championship if I'm home here and toast the new champion. When Molinari won, we put a lovely bottle of Italian wine in there and, you know, we try and make something a bit special out of it.
That is fantastic, Finchie. We're talking about memories. My favourite memory on a golf course, you won't remember, we were covering the PGA for Channel 10.
Yep.
We played 18 holes together and you were just talking about your career. And it's still such a wonderful memory for me, but I reckon on the back nine you started to explain to me about the game of golf and what it can do to you when it turns on you, which is obviously an interesting part of your story. What happened, Finchie?
What happened was I fiddled with my swing. I lost my confidence because I started to see a shot that I didn't like. And I kind of lost a bit of confidence. And then every once in a while, I'd fear that shot. And then I feared it every time I saw out of bounds stakes down the left. And then I feared it on the first tee because everyone was watching and I didn't want to hit it then. It's not like I did it all the time and my game was still really good. My short game was as great as ever. It was just a little bit of a fear factor.
Now back on the first hole, watch the Aussie, Ian Baker Finch. Watch the wind, watch his hat, and watch the ball all at once. Ouch. Hat comes off, ball goes dogleg left. I mean, it's wide of left. It's 120 yards. That's a wide fairway. He's over by the hotel, over by some of the curio shops. They sell souvenirs over where the Aussie is.
And it just sort of crept in and it got to a point where I couldn't seem to get over it or past it. And I just didn't feel, I still loved the game. I'd miss 15 cuts in a row and go home Saturday mornings and play with the guys at the club. It wasn't like I was coming home at night and kicking the cat. But I just couldn't figure out how to. I could now with what I know now when I know about the game. And, of course, the driver's the easiest club in the bag to hit now, whereas in those days it was the hardest, obviously, when you're trying to hit it far with a tiny little head. But anyway, it was a mental issue. And I think I tried to fix the physical side of it rather than trying to fix the mental side of it and allow myself to go play the way I still could, but just not under pressure. Hard to deal with for a while because it made me feel bad about myself that I couldn't get over it. You know, it's kind of embarrassing the way I played sometimes. And I wished I'd been able to maybe get angry. And sometimes I'd throw my club down the fairway when I'd hit a bad drive to try and force myself to get angry. But in the end, I'd just be laughing with the other two players I was with and, you know, joking about it rather than really being angry and maybe getting over the mental side of it that way. But anyway, I think if it happened now, I'd be better prepared to deal with it. Then it was, why am I continuing to do this? So I've got two young kids at home and a great life, and I know I could go do something else and feel better about myself. I think I'll just step away from the game and go do something different. It's funny, if I can carry on with that thought, I had missed 15 in a row in 95 and I'm
cuts
on the PGA Tour, and I missed 11 up to the British Open in 1996. And I played the Open at Lytham in 96. Tom Watson had a shoulder injury and couldn't play, and his caddy, Bruce Edwards, caddied for me. And Bruce said to me, he said, there's nothing wrong with your swing except on the tight driving holes. Why is that? I said, I wish I knew, mate. I wish I knew. But he could see, and he could see how frustrating it was for me. And it got to a point where, because I was hitting so many drivers every day to try and figure it out, it was really just with the driver. I injured my shoulders and I had to get them basically rehabbed. And I had some issues with my feet. I had to have my toes taped up to separate them, and, you know, they'd kind of cramped up with all the practice I'd been doing. So at the end of 96, I came back to Oz, and that's when I started working for Channel 10 the following year. In 96, I worked for all of the companies, ABC, 10, 9, and 7, I believe. So while I was getting the injuries fixed, I went and worked for TV. And that was the start of my career now. Inadvertently, I thought, I'll just get these injuries fixed, I'll practice hard for a year, I'll come back and be a golf pro again. But that showed other producers and other people that I was pretty good at television, or at least I could do it. And I couldn't play golf anymore and didn't play well enough to play professionally, so that was the start of it all. A
couple of things there, Finchie, and I don't want to dwell on this with you. So what is it like when the game you love becomes a real mental barrier, a mental issue, a mental torture? Like, how bad was it in your mind when you went from being top 10 to missing cut after cut? What does that do to an athlete?
Well, to me, it was demeaning. It was embarrassing. It was, I felt terrible. Everyone was watching, especially when I came back to Australia. Because I used to come back to Australia and loved it, because the crowd loved me and I loved the crowd and I loved the golf there. And when I started to play poorly, it was like I became a bit of a sideshow. You know, all the media would follow me around just to see, you know, when I was going to have a blow up. So it was the hardest thing was I couldn't figure it out. That was the worst thing for me. It wasn't just a matter of, hey, you know, I got to get fitter, or I got to get stronger, or I've got to do this, or I've got to do that. It was it was just totally mental, because I could go shoot 66 on Wednesday in the Pro-Am and I'd shoot 76 on Thursday in the tournament. So that's mental.
So what did you learn about yourself?
Some good and some bad. You know, I wished I'd been tougher. If I'd been tougher, maybe I would have been able to handle it better. I might have been able to fight my way through it. But I think the way I handled it, if you ask people that were around me at the time, they would say, boy, Finchie handled that pretty well, because it must have been tough to be on top of the world in 1991 and at the bottom of the valley in 1996, 5 years later. So I think now at my age, and talking to you and talking to various people about this now, I could probably say I'm proud of myself the way I handled it in some ways. But in other ways, I look back and think, boy, if I'd just been mentally stronger or tougher, or if someone had been able to get to me and say, just do this, right? Do this for a year, you'll get out of it. You know, I think now that's what I'd do. I'd figure it out.
Did it bring you to tears, the game, at that point?
Yeah, a couple of times it did. Yeah, for sure. And especially when I played, you know, in 96, I missed the cut at the Open and I went home and I didn't play again at all for more than 6 months. And in 97, I thought, well, I'll start practicing. And I started working with Gary Edwin, another coach up on the Gold Coast who we all know so well. And I was in the hopes of trying to play, but I wasn't really playing well enough to go compete. And I went over to the Open Championship the week before. I traveled with Gary and Grant Dodd and a buddy of mine, Kevin Cross, and we went and played golf for a week. And I was going to do the television at the Open. And when I got there, a lot of the guys, the Aussie boys, would say, Finchie, you've played in every Open since 1984. Why would you miss this one? You know, just tee it up. See how you go. So I wasn't going to play. My caddy had gone home. Kevin was going to caddy for me. He'd gone home. And Todd Woodbridge was there, and he was staying in the same hotel as us. And he said, Finchie, I'll caddy for you if you want to play. So I played, and I shot 92. I didn't play again. So that was the day. That was my fork in the road. That was the turning point. I went out. I was so nervous. I've got a big, long, flowing swing. And I look back on a few of the swings I saw on TV that day. It was like I was so stiff and sore and tight and nervous. And I hit it in every bunker and I missed every fairway and I missed every putt. And, you know, I shot 20 over par. And then that was when I decided, hey, I'm going to go do television and some course design or whatever else. So that was the day. I remember crying in the locker room. Jenny was there and Gary Edwin was over there and Todd Woodbridge, of course. And I was like, I can't do this. I'm not going to put myself through this again. So I didn't play the second day. I feel bad that I did that, but I just couldn't force myself to get up and do it again the next day. And I withdrew and went home.
More of Finchy in a moment. There are a heap of episodes in the back catalogue now, some you may have missed. Why not go back and check them out, like episode 29, featuring one of the show's most popular guests, former F1 ace Mark Webber. Dangerous caper racing cars.
An awful accident.
Because, how fast are you going?
Well, probably took off at 300.
Kilometres an hour.
Yeah, 300k. But then the car obviously decelerates a lot when you've got that whole surface area of the car braking against that. So, I mean, the speed backs off a lot, obviously, but you've still got this thing which weighs 900 kilos like a leaf just flying around. So I thought that if I go into the trees, the branches, you know, I know how thin the windscreen is on this car. You know, these cars aren't... They're designed to do a lot of things in terms of a crash, you know, impact with other cars, impact with barriers, impact with lots of different scenarios, head on, rear on, side on, rah, rah, rah. But they're not designed to go in trees. And, you know, you think about, it's incredible how when people say you have, when it all comes before you and you think you're going to, you know, you could, you know, cop it, it does slow down. The frame rate was so slow. I was thinking, I thought of Anne, mum, my sister, thought of all the obviously females in my life. I'm thinking, wow, this is it. Maybe this is, you know, 22 at Le Mans, you know, I might meet my maker here. And so it's quite intense.
That's Mark Webber on episode 29 of the show. Back to IBF. So you went into the world of television, Finchie, where now you are the man, you're a star. In those initial days in television, you've just stepped away from being a professional golfer. A lot of people, the last place they'd want to be now is a golf course after what you've described, and you're watching other people do what you were doing. Was it difficult, or did you just put it in a box and think, right, I'm done with that now. I've had a wonderful career. I've made a lot of money. I've got the trophy I've always wanted, and I'm moving forward. Like, how did you deal with the fact you were still at a golf course week in, week out?
The hardest time was the 98 Open at Royal Birkdale. That's when I started doing the television for the US. So that was the toughest time for me, was actually showing up and people saying, oh, he won it here last time and now he can't play at all. That was the hardest thing of all, was the fact people would say he can't play anymore. When I'd go out with my mates and still shoot in the 60s, I couldn't compete anymore because mentally I wouldn't allow myself to, you know, if I was 300 par coming up to last, I'd hit it out of bounds. It was just stupid stuff. It wasn't that I couldn't play. I just wasn't mentally tough enough to compete. So that was the hardest thing, I guess, for me. But once I got over that and it became more of a regular occurrence that I was there, the people on tour knew that I was a major winner and I had played well for a long while and I'd kind of lost it. And I wasn't the first professional golfer on the PGA Tour to lose his swing or lose his confidence. So most people kind of get it. I hadn't made a lot of money necessarily compared to my family, you know, just regular guys working for a salary. Yes, I had. And I owned a nice home in Sanctuary Cove on the Gold Coast and I drove a BMW. But I wasn't like the kids these days that are making tens of millions of dollars. I still needed a job and I still wanted to work and I still wanted to excel at something. So I just poured all my energy and all my resources and all my mental ability into being the best I could be at commentary. A little bit of course design I did here and there, not a lot, but so I think that was what I had learned from being a professional golfer and an athlete for so long, I then put into the other side. And you know what it takes. It's not just a matter of showing up. There's a lot more to it than that, right? And so I prided myself on that. I'd get to the tournaments early, and I think the players saw the fact that I was there Tuesdays and working hard and putting the same effort in to be a commentator or an analyst or an announcer, whatever you want to call us. and it was fun because it was golf. You know, I was still doing what you do now so well. It was fun being involved in the game that I loved and the sport that I had once excelled in. And I felt like I could relate to the players in my commentary.
This is huge for Zach Johnson. It'll feel like a major for him. The local boy, his ninth victory.
And he's done it.
With his coach Mike Bender on the bag, Zach Johnson takes home his hometown event. He's got to be ecstatic.
Let's talk about golf broadcasting then, if you've got a little bit more time. What's the key to your job, do you think, when you're on the biggest broadcast on the planet now in golf? What's the key to successful golf announcing or commentary, as we call it here?
You've got to entertain the audience.
That's the center of the green as he looks at it. That's a good looking shot, and he's a kick to the left.
Beautiful. Spectacular shot.
Oh my goodness, what a shot! He does not know how close that is.
Truly remarkable.
People are investing. Over here, it's on for 3 hours. I wish in Australia it was only on for 3 hours instead of five or six, because it's oversaturated and it's too long and no one watches for 6 hours with all those ads. So people are investing that amount of time in you and your show and your team, and we're supposed to entertain you and keep you tuned in. So I feel like I've got a good balance of that. I know the players, I know the game, I know the business now, and I like to feel like our team, it's not about me, it's about the team that's broadcasting. Jim Nance is the best announcer in the world, and he is such a team player. It's not all about Jim. It is all about Jim in a way, because he brings us on the air and says, "Hello, friends. Nice to have you here. I'm glad you've invited me into your living room today." That's his attitude.
"Hello, friends. Welcome to this tradition unlike any other, the Masters on CBS."
And that's how I like it to be too. So I try and include everyone in the team. Talk to Frank Novello. Talk to Nick Faldo. Bring Dottie in. Bring Trevor or Mark Immelman in. You know, it used to be Peter Costas out on the course. Bring them in, you know, include them. And that's what I feel people want to hear. They want to hear experts, golfers, talk golf and entertain them. And that's what I try to do.
It's really interesting you say that, Finchie. And one of the reasons I wanted to do this podcast is because whenever people talk to me about broadcasting, I always tell them this story. And this is a podcast about you, but I really want to tell you this story. We were working together on golf at Channel 10, and I hadn't covered much golf, and I was out on course. And we'd done a couple of tournaments, and then Tiger came for the Emirates Australian Open, and it was kid in a candy store for me to follow Tiger Woods round. And I can remember on the first day, I was extremely nervous, and I was out there following Tiger, not being a golf expert, but trying to broadcast my way through it. And about the third time they came down to me, it was you and Grades, and I said something, and you said, "He's spot on there, Mark Howard. That's exactly what they're trying to do. Couldn't have said it better myself." And I had so many people text me exactly after you said that, because so many people were watching Tiger play. A lot of mates saying, "Wow, I didn't know you knew so much about golf. Wow, you're doing a great job." But it was only because someone at your stature had complimented me to bring me into the part of the team, which is what you were doing, that the audience then had confidence in me and I had confidence in myself.
Jason Day just needs to get this close and take...
Yeah, I agree. Howie just escaped with the bogey. Let's see how this comes onto the green surface here, if it runs in there smoothly or if it bounces through that kikuyu grass.
It's a massive upslope too, Finchie. He's got about a 2 metre to get above that rise, which he's done now, and he needs it to keep rolling.
That's exactly what I meant by where he left his second shot in trouble. You bring double bogey into play.
And it was the most generous thing anyone has ever done to me in sports broadcasting ever, Finchie. And I've never told you, and I should have told you, but it was such a simple thing you did that just gave me the confidence to go and do it. And now I try and do that with people that I work with.
Good.
And you taught me a tremendous lesson, Ian, that day.
Good. Thank you. It's very true, isn't it? If you there's so many ways you can explain it, but if everyone on the team, if you polish their buttons, the coat will shine brighter, right? If you make sure that everyone's doing well and feels good and doing their job, and it just makes the whole team better. And at the end of the day, like your mate's calling and saying, hey, isn't that great? You know, you're really doing a good job. But you were doing a good job, but now you felt like you were doing a good job, so you did a better job because you felt good about yourself. And that's the game. That's the broadcasting game, is what I mean. If we all are doing a good job, and Jim Nance is so good at it. Mike Tirico is another one that you would know in broadcasting.
Yes.
It's just a genius broadcaster, and so inclusive and so friendly and so inviting. And I would watch a show just because Jim Nance or Mike Tirico was doing the announcing, because I know it's going to be special. And I think there's another guy that does such a good job now in the States is Tony Romo. Tony Romo is fantastic. And Jim brought him in, and they're mates now. Jim Nance and Tony Romo are partners doing the NFL. And we see the NFL on Monday mornings in Australia. You know, we see that the NFL on Sundays. Anyway, he's that same way. It's inviting. It's enjoyable. It's rewarding. That 3 hours you invest in listening to them, I don't really care sometimes about who wins the game. I've enjoyed listening to them, their commentary. And I think that's what we do well at CBS. Younger audiences wish we were on HBO and we could say really what we wanted to say sometimes, you know, but you can't, as you know. It's a family environment, network television. So we have to be careful, and sometimes it's a little dumbed down in a way. But at the end of the day, if everyone's having a good time and there's a few jokes and a bit of laughter, which you do so well with the cricket, you get the guys laughing and have a good time, it's enjoyable to listen to. And that's what makes it fun. As I said, it's entertainment, isn't it? Yes, we're covering a golf tournament. And yes, I'm lucky enough to be working on the Masters, and you want to see the golf. But it's also, we have to entertain the viewer.
I love that description of polishing the buttons. And thank you for your kind words about the cricket. But that's why I wanted to tell you that story, because I've tried to do in the cricket what you showed me was the way on the golf. On the flip side of that, Finchie, we live in a world of social media, and I can come off calling a game of footy or doing a game of Big Bash or a test match or whatever it may be, and you cannot please all the people all the time, Finchie.
No.
And the modern world lets those that aren't being pleased to let you know directly via social media. How do you deal with the negativity that we get in the modern sports media, in the modern world, really? I don't think it's probably as bad in America as it is in Australia, because America as a nation is a very positive place. But how do you deal with those that say, oh, come on, what are you doing?
Yeah, exactly. I had to stop looking at Instagram and Twitter until Mondays. I never look at it on the weekends. If there is anything that I've said that's a bit stupid, you know, they're quick to let you know, as you know. I'm pretty fortunate that I'm not one of the ones they attack. A couple of the guys really get attacked. They can be quite nasty. It should be called unsocial media, actually, not social media.
Yes.
Because the loudest voices are always the assholes. They're the you know, the trolls, the faceless Monday morning quarterbacks, they call them over here, that know everything about the game. And that's a shame. First thing I did when I started to understand what was going on with social media, you know, 6 or 7 years ago, I never looked at it during the week. I would have someone tell me if there was something that was good content that could help me be better at what I was doing, but I didn't want to see it. I didn't want to see the pointed comments, if there were any. But, I think that's one of the biggest things. And Jim Nance isn't on any social media, for instance. And I don't think Mike Tirico does it anymore either. It's like Nick Faldo had a terrible relationship with the British press when he played. And I've been asking him about this lately because we've been spending a lot more time doing these telecasts in Orlando. And he said he never read the papers. He never once for about a decade read a paper. And if he did hear of any one particular nasty media person doing something really destructive towards his character, he would refuse to do a press conference in the presence of that person. He basically just wiped them. So but he was so resilient, you see. He and Greg were really mentally tough, and that's why they got to number one in the world. They were capable. Curtis Strange was another great one, really, really good player, just mentally tough, you know. I wished I'd been able to be a bit more that way. But you have to push it to the side and just keep doing what you do. And there's always going to be, as you know, you can have the best game of your life and there's going to be 10 guys the next morning say, oh, they got to get rid of that Mark Howard. He doesn't know what he's talking about. You know, you got to let it go, haven't you? I mean, what can we do?
Finchie, long-term listeners to this show know that I have a couple of kids that ask questions of our guest. I tell them a little bit about them, normally over breakfast. We're doing this early Australian time, so it was last night over dinner. They formulate their own question. You get my 10-year-old daughter by the name of Skye.
Skye,
who
lovely.
Operates as the Pickle. That's her nickname, Finchie. Mm-hmm. Hopefully you can hear this all the way in Florida. Here is the Pickle for you.
Hi, Finchie. Pickle here. A few weeks ago, we had Adam Scott on our podcast for the 100th episode. We watched him win the Masters, and you were commentating. It was really good. And in the commentary box, did you get nervous because it was the first Australian to ever win the Masters?
Oh, Pickle's a smart girl. Very nice. Yes, I did. And yes, I was crying when he won.
A life changer.
Oh. An unbelievable, magical moment. He is now officially the Wizard of Oz.
Jim Nance threw it to me, and I'd been out in the boondocks down on the tower at 12 all afternoon, freezing cold in the rain as play goes through. I'm down on Amen Corner, seriously, as I may as well have been in church. It was awesome, just awesome. And Jim threw it to me when Adam won, and I said, from down under to on top of the world.
And Ian,
it's green and gold, Jim. From down under to on top of the world, Jim.
And at the time, it really was all I could get out, but it was actually so poignant because as an Australian, that's what he was at that time, right? He had won the Masters all those years that all the other players had had a chance, Greg especially, so many times. Someone had finally won that jacket. From memory, I think it was the 73rd playing of the Masters, or 73 years, you know, we'd been trying to get a winner, an Aussie winner. Yeah, I think that's what the number was. So 2013. Yes, Pickle, I was nervous. I was very emotional and happy to see Adam win. He deserved it.
It brought you to tears, did it?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah, I'm still a bit choked up even now talking about it. And the same when Jason Day won in 2015 at Whistling Straits, he won the USPGA. I was pretty emotional about it because I knew how hard he'd worked. You know, another Queensland boy had come from a tough beginning. So yeah, I'm vested in the Aussie boys and love to see them do well over here. I don't get to see them that much because they all kind of do their own thing when they're at a tournament, and I'm doing what we have to do, the TV thing. But whenever I get a chance, I text them or wish them well or catch up with them. We've got a good bunch of Aussie boys right now. We've got a really good bunch of Aussie players.
We do. And it was a treat to have Adam on the show, and he talked us through the closing stages and the playoff, and it still gives me goosebumps thinking about it now.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
Okay. Now you get my 8-year-old Finchie.
Okay.
Now he's a bit of a loose cannon, Finchie. His name is Mac. But he rolls as the Big Penguin. You're never quite sure, Finchie, what he's going to go with the Big Penguin.
Oh, boy.
But sometimes he does, and I say, no, mate, you can't go with that, but yours is appropriate. So here you go.
Hi, Finchie, Big Penguin here. I've been been to quite a few places, such as Thailand, South Africa, Zimbabwe, Zambia, Costa Rica, Panama, America, and Guatemala.
Wow.
The thing I miss most is the peanut butter we get here in Australia. I love it so much, but I don't think you can get it in Thailand, South Africa, Zimbabwe, Zambia, and all the other places I've been. I heard you live in America. But what's the thing you most miss about Australia?
That is an excellent question. They're going to take your job, mate, your two kids.
They're well-travelled for youngsters.
Oh, my goodness. He must have gone to all of the great surfing places in the world, has he?
Spot on, Finchie.
Yeah,
you're
I
on
like
it.
That. Three or four of them I know are the best ever,
yes.
Right?
Yes, yes.
You know, I have it in the fridge and I always do, is Vegemite. Americans right. don't get it. They love the Tim Tams that we give them. We always bring Tim Tams back with us. So I love the Tim Tams. Americans love Tim Tams too. Americans hate Vegemite. They don't understand. But they spread it on like you spread on the peanut butter. They spread it on too thick, you know. What I miss most about Australia is home and the beaches. Yeah, I think that's the most. That's why I like to go home. When I come home to Australia, come home to the Sunshine Coast. The best golf, of course, is in Melbourne on the Sandbelt. I love the golf on the Sandbelt in Melbourne. I could spend a month there just playing those courses every day. But the beaches and the coast and the lifestyle in Australia is what I miss the most.
Final question for you, and you've been so good with your time talking about the kids, and you're a father and now a grandfather or a pop or whatever mm-hmm. it may become. For all the kids, and we're lucky that a lot of kids listen to this show, Finchie, with their parents. For the kids that want to achieve something in their life, in their passion, whether it be sport or music or the arts or academia, what's one bit of advice you could give the youngsters that are hoping to achieve some success?
Oh, just love what it is you're doing. Really embrace it, love it, internalize it, and have fun with it. Don't make it hard work. Yes. If you want to be really, really good at anything you really love, you have to work hard to be good at it because everyone else is trying to get there too and you have to work a little harder than they are. But at the same time, you've got to enjoy the path and, smell the roses, if you will, the great old saying. But, yeah, just love it and enjoy it.
Ian, you're a wonderful, wonderful man. I cannot thank you enough for coming on the Howie Games. You've thrilled me with some of your stories, especially that golden bear story.
Sorry,
mate,
I didn't know the kids.
For joining me.
I didn't know the kids were listening.
No, mate, I appreciate it. And what I said to you about the golf commentary, it stuck with me forever and a day. So thanks a lot, mate. Thanks for coming on the show.
Great to be with you, Mark. Really appreciate it. Cheers, bud.
What a golfing journey Ian has had. Some serious highs to the crushing lows that he talked about when his game deserted him. But throughout, Finchie has always retained his warmth and friendly nature. Whenever anyone mentions Ian, they always say the same thing at some point. What a great bloke. Thanks to Ian for coming on. And as you heard, thanks to Finchie also for teaching me the most valuable broadcasting lesson I've ever learned. A shout out to Das, who is on fire as always, putting this whole thing together. And most importantly, thanks to all you cool cats for tuning in. Scotty James's player profile, then full episode coming up over the next two Thursdays. Until then, peace and love.
And we can do it if we try, try, try. If we try, try, try. If we try, try, try.
Listener.